we can see that illuminated sign that marks the end of the journey.
This vaccine will help us get past this pandemic once and for all.
We need people to have faith that this vaccine is safe and that they should take it. The thing that's going to stop us from seeing the end of this pandemic are people going, oh, I'm not so sure.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Roger Hearing.
Good afternoon, I'm Ewan Potts. The news that on Tuesday the UK recorded no COVID deaths for the first time since the pandemic began has ramped up the pressure on Boris Johnson.
The good news comes amid debate over ending restrictions. Business leaders are seeing it as clear vindication of the plan to end all restrictions on June the 21st. But at the same time, we continue to see a rise in cases linked to the Delta variant. That's the one that originated in India. Now, a large number of government advising scientists have publicly called for a delay to the lifting of lockdown restrictions. Devi Sridhar is a professor of global public health and says we should be driven by the data.
We thought it would be over by Christmas, and it wasn't. So the end of the pandemic is in sight. That's the good news. We have a way out of this with vaccines and therapeutics. It just may not be June 21st. It might be a week or two later. And so I think that's the kind of attitude we need to have, rather than fixating on that date being success or failure.
And Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has put easy on hold for millions of Scots because of concerns around growing case numbers.
Many public health experts are warning that the UK could, and I stress could, now be at the start of a third wave of the virus. And obviously, it would be wrong to completely ignore that warning.
Much of Scotland's central belt is in level two restrictions.
Well, joining us now is Alison Tullis, MP for Glasgow Central, a Shadow Treasury spokesperson for the SNP. Alison, thank you so much for being with us today. First of all, just clarify, what sort of restrictions is Glasgow in at the moment, and how are people reacting to that?
So Glasgow is going to be moving from level three to level two, which I'm very pleased about. And lots of people in Glasgow are also quite pleased about that. So that moves sort of on Saturday, 5th of June. So that means hospitality settings, including pubs, restaurants and cafes, up to six people can meet indoors from up to three households. Alcohol can then be served indoors up to 10:30, and venues such as cinemas, theatres, casinos, snooker halls can reopen. So people are pleased to see that. And that is a progress for Glasgow, because we've been in level three that wee bit longer.
Yeah, I was going to say, Glasgow's been under pretty tight restrictions for some time. What's the mood been like amongst the people in your constituency?
I mean, people understand why we have to have these restrictions. It's about stopping the spread of the virus, and we had a significant uptick in numbers in Glasgow, which we're beginning to see the end of, hopefully, with additional vaccination and additional testing. So people do understand that, but it has been very tough, particularly for businesses and for people who've not been able to leave Glasgow to go and see family or have people come and visit them. It has been very difficult.
And I'm sure you've had constituents come and say to you, Alison, as many MPs have, you know, why is it necessary given the high number of vaccinations? Scotland's done very well on this, and the low death numbers. I mean, the UK as a whole had no deaths from COVID-19 for the first time since the pandemic began yesterday.
Yeah, I think that you just heard from Devi Sridhar there as well about we're not quite out of this yet. And if we were to remove all restrictions right away, then we could end up in a worse situation, because the virus just needs that contact to spread. And this new variant, the Delta variant that's been talked about, would appear to be causing lots of cases to emerge in other parts of the UK as well. So it's something we need to be really cautious about. We can't kind of underplay the risk that this virus causes, particularly for those who haven't yet got their vaccinations. Not everybody has managed to get that yet. And it is still a very serious illness that people can have. They can either, even if it's not enough to hospitalise you or enough to put you in intensive care, long COVID can be really quite serious. And I've got a number of constituents who are affected by that and are still, not back to full health months later. So it is something we really need to be careful with.
It'd be good to talk about the economic measures a little bit. The furlough scheme from Westminster has widely been seen as a success by many commentators. Are you happy with what's been put in place on the economic front?
Yes, now I think I would like to see the furlough and the self-employed support scheme just extended that wee bit further, because, as I say, we don't know whether we're going to be fully able to come out of these restrictions as the government wants. And we found last year when employers had to pay a bit more into the furlough scheme that really did put them under a lot of pressure. Now we're months and months down the line, lots of businesses have taken on additional debts and they're really struggling with rent and rates and other things that they have to pay. So I think it is worth considering whether that can be extended a wee bit longer September just to give businesses that a bit of extra support.
And I suppose a lot of people are going to say, hang on, if England comes out of restrictions after June the 21st, and there are a number of government support schemes that cease around the same time, particularly in the hospitality industry, it's going to be very difficult for Scotland to maintain a different system, isn't it?
Well, I think we were in this situation last year as well, where Scotland and Wales were asking for that additional support, asking for support to be extended, and it wasn't until the virus was taking hold in England that the UK government decided to change their minds. Now, we don't want to be in that situation at all, but I think it is worth making sure that we're all looking after the businesses that need supported, and the Scottish Government Finance Minister will be making further announcements on this later today, I understand. But I think where the UK government has the powers here, it should be making sure that people right across the UK are protected and they shouldn't cut things off at an arbitrary date. And I'm a wee bit worried about this 21st of June date, because it has been seen and it has been shown in the media as being some sort of freedom day or something like that. And you go, no, we have to take things gradually. We have to keep careful about this. Otherwise, we're going to end up right back where we were before, because this is what happened last summer. This is what happened at Christmas time. We thought things were all fine and things could go back to normal, and that really wasn't the case. So I would urge caution and urge people to listen to people like Debbie Schroeder with the public health expertise. We think we need to take this gradually and we need to stay cautious.
More than 10,000 people have died from COVID since the start of the pandemic in Scotland. Do you think that Scottish Government could have done more to keep that number lower?
I think Nicola Sturgeon and other government officials in Scotland have said, you know, if we had the benefit of hindsight, we would have done things differently. And Nicola's been very upfront about that and has said that we should have this public inquiry to establish what happened and what went wrong and what we could have done better. Because I think that is really important that we look at this holistically, because everybody accepts that there have been mistakes made. But if you think back to how we felt in March and April last year, it was chaotic and it was scary and it was dangerous, and decisions were taken at speed and because we didn't know exactly what we were dealing with. So I think there is always more that could have been done. And I think from the UK government side as well, the ability for people to travel in and out of the country is what receded the virus last year in the summer. So again, you know, there could have been different approaches taken, which would have helped. And if you look at the way that Australia and New Zealand are managing the virus as well, they're managing to get rid of that that risk of the virus completely. So I think there's a lot that could have been done differently. And I'm sure that in time the public inquiry will get to some of those answers.
Alison, let me move you on to a different subject, which is your own party. Now, very publicly, your colleague Joanna Cherry announced she was leaving the SNP's ruling body this week, saying she'd been prevented from, and I quote, fulfilling her mandate of improving transparency and scrutiny in the party. A lot of people scratching their heads about this. What's going on inside the SNP at the moment?
I mean, I must admit, I'm also scratching my head on this, because I also sit on the SNP's NEC and have not. I don't feel as though I've seen the problems that Joanna Cherry is describing. And I think it is unfortunate that she's decided to take that decision. But that's where we are. But the party is in very good heart. We've just had an absolutely historic election result. We've done incredibly well in the polls. We have the backing of the Scottish public to carry out our mandate. And I think for people to sort of say that there's any kind of splits within the SNP is a gross exaggeration of the situation. The party is in good heart and we've got an increased membership as well.
Douglas Chapman resigned as the party's treasurer very recently as well. So this is more than one MP resigning. Is there something up at the higher echelons of the SNP at the moment?
I mean, as I say, certainly not that I can see. And I respect colleagues and the decisions that they've taken, but that's certainly not the feeling that I have serving the NEC. And I think it's a good bunch of people who are committed to working very hard to take us further to independence. And I hope that we will be able to achieve that very soon.
But Alison, I mean, you talk about these people as if they're in a different planet. I mean, have you spoken to Joanna? Have you spoken to the other people who stood back? I mean, have you got a sense of what's going on? You surely are in communication.
I haven't had the chance to speak to all colleagues, although I was in touch with Douglas. But I can't. I'm also on the same body as them. I don't see things in the same way as they do. But we've just come out of this tremendous election success. We are a party with an increased membership, with an increased mandate, and we are, as I say, in good heart, and branches are very much up for the campaigns ahead.
I want to just push you a little bit on that. Is there a feeling that that things are a little bit dysfunctional at the top of the party at the moment? I appreciate you had a pretty good election, but there does seem to be a lot of internal goings on. What's happening there?
As I say, you know, overwhelmingly the party is in good heart, and there's no kind of dispute there at all. Save for a few people, but. I think all parties will have disagreements at various different times, and this is no different to that.
Okay, but Alison, let me say, if I were a voter, if I were an SNP voter, and I saw this happening, I think I'd expect from someone like yourself some kind of sense of what's going on. You know, just staying back, I don't know what's going on. It doesn't sound very convincing as a voter.
Well, the voters have just given us have just put their faith in the SNP in overwhelming numbers. We've had the highest number of votes that any party has received in the devolution era in Scotland.
But now the party seems to be falling apart, so that doesn't make sense.
Well, I think the notion of internal conflict is much, much overstated. And so it feels to me as if there are some who want to kind of to play that game and to say that there is a dispute, when in fact there isn't.
Let's have a look now at what else is making news in the world of politics. And the government's unveiled plans for a big expansion in tutoring. The goal is to help millions of children catch up after their schools were closed during the pandemic. £1.4 billion has been allocated for what's being called a national tutoring revolution.
But critics say the plan doesn't go far enough. Labour's Shadow Education Secretary Kate Green has accused the Conservatives of showing no ambition for children's futures.
It's a revolution that falls woefully inadequate of what the government's own education expert, Sir Kevin Collins, is suggesting is needed. And I'm afraid it badly lets down our children and young people.
Labour has published a two-year education recovery plan that would cost nearly £15 billion.
Now, from education to transport, and ministers have demanded that Transport for London pushes ahead with work to introduce driverless trains on the Underground as part of a £1 billion rescue package announced earlier this week. Now, the Department for Transport is going to run a joint programme with TfL to explore the business case for fully automated trains on the Piccadilly and the Waterloo and City lines. But transport unions immediately warned of industrial action in response, and the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, promised to reject any future demand to implement driverless trains.
And sign language is going to be used to deliver important passenger information at a train station for the first time in England. 10 touchscreens go live at Euston Station here in London with pre-recorded messages. The messages were used to communicate things like an evacuation, announcements that are usually made over the public address system. Any live updates like unexpected delays can also be uploaded to the portals within an hour.
Now, it all speaks to a situation, I think, that's rather crucial. In fact, one we were highlighting on this programme only a few weeks ago, which is the plight of blind or deaf people during this crisis, which many people have accused the Westminster government of simply ignoring.
Right, well, let's chew over some of the day's big issues now with Bloomberg opinion columnist Therese Raphael. Thanks for joining us, Therese. Let's start off with the rumbling sore for the government that is the Green Seal lobbying scandal. You wrote a great piece this morning on the Bloomberg Terminal on the website where you say that some powerful figures in British economic policy and supervision missed or ignored warning signals. Now, just recap for us where we're at with uncovering the lobbying which went on at the height of the pandemic last year.
Yeah, so we've had the Treasury Select Committee holding hearings over a number of weeks. We've had David Cameron's testimony, Lex Greensill's testimony, Rishi Sunak's testimony. So a lot of big names have been in there. And with all of those hours of testimony, you'd think we would have learned a great deal about how Greensill got access to a government guaranteed, a government-backed loan scheme that could expose the British taxpayers to £400 million of coverage if they are unable to repay those loans. Unfortunately, there are so many questions that are still have not been answered, because while the Bank of England and the Treasury can say that they've done nothing wrong, that they played by the books, that they turned down Greensill's application for access to the very large financing scheme, and that was on qualification grounds. The fact is Greensill did get access to a scheme run by the British Business Bank, but we haven't heard from the British Business Bank. We haven't heard from the Department for Business. And we asked both the Treasury Select Committee and the British Business Bank if there were plans for testimony and before the parliamentary recess. There weren't any. So we've called in this op-ed to keep asking those questions and, you know, try to sort of unpack just how Greensill did get access to the loan scheme, given that there were so many flags about Greensill's relations with Gupta, questions about business practices. We have the bank in Germany that was under investigation. Weiland's bank in Scotland was under investigation. So a lot of these flags were available to any official that was looking into Greensill, and still he got plenty of access at the very highest ranks of government and ultimately to a loan scheme. And we just don't know enough about what due diligence was done there.
But, Therese, there are a number of inquiries going on into this. Certainly MPs are pursuing it with some vigour. I guess the answers you're seeking probably will come from those, because they're certainly trying to push this pretty hard.
Yeah, let's hope so. To be fair to the Treasury Select Committee, they didn't rule out calling for testimony from the British Business Bank or the Department of Business. They simply haven't done so to date, and there are no plans. And, you know, there's a danger that all of the focus on David Cameron and his lobbying efforts is a bit of a distraction, because ultimately we know that the Bank of England was very aware of what was going on, or at least some of the questions and suspicions around Greensill. The Treasury, would have been aware as well from news reports. And so there's a question of, you know, what are the intragovernmental communications around Greensill? What did they look like? And, you know, could they have been better? And what lessons can be learned from that? And I suspect we will get more testimony that delves into that. We just haven't had it so far.
Yeah, kind of on that subject, do you think there's a sort of systemic problem with lobbying in this country? Do we need to clear up the rules, make things more transparent, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, lobbying is part of a market democracy, and I wouldn't go so far as to say that, you know, we shouldn't have lobbying or that there's something inherently wrong with lobbying. But the key is transparency, and clearly, to the extent that we don't know precisely, you know, who said what to whom and what kind of signals were responded to, yes, that's a problem. And we've now seen from many of the transcripts that have been published that this lobbying was really extensive. And it just shows how easy it is to open doors when you have very, high-level people like David Cameron on your books. But I think, you know, the answer to it all is transparency, transparency, transparency. And, we're just only beginning to understand the extent of Lex Greensill's network in government. And what's not clear is exactly whether, how and whether that helped him gain access to loan schemes that, with a bit more due diligence, would likely have been closed to him.
Yes, sunlight being the greatest antiseptic, as is often said. But let's move on to something else, Therese, which is to do with the way the government could be trying, or is seeming to be able to try, to put back the education that was lost during the pandemic. And tutoring does seem to be the focus of this. A tutoring revolution, we're told. The government putting quite a lot of money into this, but people pointing out that things like, for example, extending the school day or even trimming holidays, neither of them, I'm sure, popular with children, might be a better and perhaps more efficient way of doing this.
Yeah, I mean, I think the government was right to launch this tutoring revolution and to focus in on tutoring, because the studies that have been done to date show that tutoring really helps. And not only does it help, it helps with a relatively, small amount of investment. So with up to, 12 weeks of tutoring, say once a week tutoring, the studies that were done by the Tutor Trust and others show that children actually make quite substantial progress. And we know in Britain that even before the pandemic, there is huge inequality in education. There's 1.4 million children on free school meals. And by the time they reach 16, poor students were already lagging their richer peers by substantially. So tutoring, I think, is a big part of the answer. The problem is, you know, the government has put in, initially they put in, I think it was £1 billion for a national catch-up package, and that included £350 million for tutoring. Now they've just announced another billion. However, if you look at what the education establishment saying is needed, the Education Policy Institute says that what's required is $13.5 billion over 3 years. And, you know, even Kevin Collins, the government's own education recovery czar, thinks that the government needs to spend something around $15 billion. So what's actually being proposed, if, you know, you go by those estimates, is really a drop in the bucket. And you know, the risk is that, you know, you just don't do enough to make up the gap. And that is probably, you know, one of the biggest scar we're going to have from this pandemic long term is the impact on young children who've fallen so far behind in their education.
Yeah, very tough for the class of 2020. I read that a review of classroom time is set to report later this year. There could be changes coming on that front.
Yes, there could be. And, you know, I guess you have to ask, you know, at what cost? So if children have extended days, for example, are they going to lose out in recreation and extracurricular activities and that sort of things? It may make sense, but already the British school day is quite a long day. If you compare it to, say, American school children who are often out at, you know, 2:30 or 3 in the afternoon, and then they play sports in the afternoon. So, you know, you're taking a long day, you're extending it further. That may be an answer temporarily, but, you know, I'm not convinced that the costs in terms of well-being for children are really worth it. I'd like to see more money spent on individual tutors for the worst off children, group tutors for some, and I think that can be done at quite a low cost because you have a lot of college students, university students, who are willing to give a couple of hours a week at, you know, a fairly reasonable hourly rate to help out with this catch-up program. And so I think it's a great thing for young people to help out with, and it's you know, it would be very beneficial for these kids, but it needs to be funded.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.